From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Cambodia holds an election and China wins, and U.S. airlines bow to pressure from Beijing. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, coming to you from our studio here in Midtown Manhattan. And I am pleased to welcome my friend and colleague, Hugo Restall, who is calling in from an undisclosed location yet again, somewhere out there in Asia Pacific. Maybe he's sipping something under a veranda or having tea. Who knows? Hello, Hugo. Great to have you back on the show. So let's start in a country that we don't talk much about, Cambodia. Prime Minister Hun Sen declaring victory in the Southeast Asian nation. And it wasn't really a fair fight, was it, Hugo?
No, this was the ultimate sham election. Basically, the last time we talked about Cambodia was probably when they disbanded the main opposition party last year and put its leader on trial for treason. So when the opposition is in jail, that's the ultimate walkover.
It's a sign that maybe this is not going to be a competitive contest. You're referring, of course, to Kem Sokha, Cambodia National Rescue Party. That nearly won back in 2013. So they clearly represented a threat to Hun Sen. But Hugo, no real pushback here because the opposition couldn't push back. You've got a man in Hun Sen, a former Khmer Rouge cadre, who really controlled all of the various powers, not just of government and not just shutting down the opposition, but also shutting down any kind of free media or civil society group that would have exposed the various ways that he rigged this election. The Phnom Penh Post, the Cambodia Daily, two English language dailies, shuttered. National Democratic Institute expelled. Radio Free Asia shut down. That's, of course, U.S. taxpayer funded. Really, when you're faced with that, what option do Cambodians really have other than to, I don't know, boycott the polls?
Right. And even that, Hun Sen was making veiled threats that people who didn't vote were enemies of democracy. And considering that the Cambodian People's Party has a stranglehold over a lot of the local commune-level governments, they can see who's going to vote and not going to vote. And so there's a very real danger for people who didn't turn out to vote. So I think that's one reason the turnout was very high, is that it's becoming a bit like North Korea or another totalitarian regime where the turnout is climbing towards 90%, and the share of the vote for the ruling party is also headed in that direction.
Yeah, and what a shame for a country that, of course, experienced such total devastation in the 70s and 80s under the grip of the Khmer Rouge. For those of you who don't recall, they wanted to achieve year zero, so-called, and they went around slaughtering tens of thousands of people in very, very brutal ways. A quarter of the population. I mean, and Hugo, you know, for a population that went through that to now be suffering under this totalitarian state is really to pile one insult after another.
Well, essentially, Hun Sen has been in power since the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia and throughout the Khmer Rouge. And the United Nations tried to reconstruct the country and put in place a democracy. The problem is that in 1993, when they did that, they spent billions of dollars restoring law and order to the country. But when they held elections, Hun Sen didn't win, and he simply refused to give up power. And so the UN acquiesced to a power-sharing agreement between him and the Royalist Party, and he very quickly pushed the Royalists out and resumed essentially one-party rule. But ever since then, Hun Sen has been careful to maintain a fig leaf of democracy, using his hold over the apparatus of government and the advantages that brings to maintain power. It's only in the last few years when the public anger against his government grew so great with the land grabs where he was allowing politically connected people to buy confiscated land from the government. So ordinary people were losing their land and seeing it go to Hun Sen's cronies, and then also essentially selling parts of the country to China and selling Cambodia's vote at the United Nations and within ASEAN to China. That anger grew so great that Hun Sen made a calculation that he could just go it alone without aid from the West and simply aid from Beijing.
And that's what he's done. That is such an important point, and disturbing, too, because China, by propping up Hun Sen, and let's be honest, I mean, they're propping him up. They're funneling a lot of money into the country, building construction projects, infrastructure, you name it. Also really footing the bill for the election, too, an election that U.S. observers and others just declared rigged and refused to participate in or observe as they usually do. This is a very strategically located country. I mean, it's right on the Gulf of Thailand. It's ringed by Vietnam, Thailand, and Laos. And Hugo, if China controls Cambodia, that's a pretty important port for China. And it expands their sphere of influence in a very, very meaningful way. I don't see really a lot of options for the United States or allies, democratic allies in the region, to alleviate that interest as Hun Sen really just becomes, I would say, in Cambodia becomes a proxy state for Beijing.
Right. I mean, parts of the country are already essentially colonies of China. The leverage that the U.S. has, one of the pieces of leverage it has is that a lot of Cambodia's textile exports, and textiles are the largest industry there, go to the U.S. under very favorable terms. The U.S. has granted Cambodia very low tariffs and quotas in the past. That is something that Hun Sen doesn't really want to lose, but he seems to have made the calculation that he can afford to risk that. So the U.S., can choose to use that leverage. Of course, it's natural to hesitate to use that since Cambodia is an extremely poor country and you would be inflicting a lot of suffering on ordinary Cambodians. So far, the U.S. has confined itself to sanctioning individuals, and that may be expanded now after this election.
It might be. We'll see. But, Hugo, it's a theme that we talk about a lot. It's not just China oppressing its own people. It's expanding that authoritarian way of governing to its near abroad. But, when you talk about a place like Cambodia, it doesn't even border China. So, I guess it still counts as the near abroad. But, this to me is a very, very disturbing trend that the United States should be paying a heck of a lot more attention to.
Right. It's China is expanding its influence ASEAN as a whole. And if it can succeed in fracturing ASEAN, it will have gone a long way towards solidifying its control over the South China Sea and pushing the U.S. out of the strategic area.
That's, of course, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations set up really to encourage trade and to hopefully push that part of the world toward freer and more liberal societies. If China is looming, where will it go? We're talking about the Cambodia election, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from the Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York, Hugo Restall somewhere out there in Asia Pacific, and returning to one of our favorite countries, Taiwan, but not with good news. U.S. airlines, including the likes of Delta, American, United, and Hawaiian, are changing their websites at the behest of the Chinese government in Beijing, kowtowing to pressure to change how they refer to the Democratic Island of Taiwan. Hugo, what exactly is Beijing up to here?
So China wants to force all foreign companies to recognize Taiwan as being part of China. And it set a July 25th deadline for the U.S. airlines to change their website so that on their drop-down menus, Taiwan would not be shown as a separate country, but as part of China. And the Trump administration, initially to its credit, said that the U.S. airlines should not comply with this, and that the U.S. government would negotiate with Beijing on this issue and stop this quote-unquote Orwellian nonsense. But China simply refused to engage in talks, and there was nothing much that the U.S. government could do about it, and the airlines were left in this awkward situation of potentially losing their routes to mainland China, which, of course, are quite lucrative and growing. And so in the end, they knuckled under.
Hugo, is this a situation where the U.S. airlines could have teamed up with their European counterparts or their other Asian counterparts so that they'd have a bit more leverage here, so that it wasn't just the four airlines on their own against the Communist Party in China?
I think it would have been very difficult for that to happen. I mean, ultimately, it would have to be a government decision to form a coalition to resist this. But even then, it's hard to see what the U.S. might have done if the Chinese had gone ahead and sanctioned the airlines. Would they have sanctioned Chinese airlines in retaliation? What would be the legal basis for that? Kind of the Trump administration talked to itself into a corner where it couldn't back up what it was saying, and the airlines were left to hold the bag. So I have some sympathy for them, and this is largely a symbolic issue. The real issue is that China is trying to intimidate companies and governments around the world into not recognizing Taiwan and restricting Taiwan's international space in more meaningful ways, such as participating in international organizations. And that has a real impact on the island of Taiwan and hurts other countries, you know, that could benefit from Taiwan's involvement.
Yeah, and the tactics are really horrible, Hugo. We often have Taiwanese delegations coming in here to the editorial page telling us about all the shenanigans that go on just a couple blocks away from here at the United Nations, where if you're an observer from Taiwan, the Chinese insist that you have to show a Chinese ID, that you can't get in if you're a Taiwanese NGO or other kinds of organizations unless you show a freely provided Chinese ID. Of course, China famously does not let Taiwan, infamously, I should say, into the World Health Organization, which presents a threat to everyone because, of course, you want every country sharing information about diseases and the like. Hugo, this can't convince the Taiwanese people that it would be a great idea to reunify with China. I mean, if that's how they treat them, doesn't it just alienate the Taiwanese public and make them even more resolute to stay independent, free, and democratic and not submit to these bullies in Beijing?
Well, definitely. And I think the reason that this is being ramped up at the moment is that currently there's a Democratic Progressive Party administration in Taiwan, which has traditionally been pro-independence. So Since that party came to power in 2016, Beijing has ramped up the harassment, ramped up the intimidation. There are military exercises going on around Taiwan. And so essentially it's a bid to interfere in the domestic politics of Taiwan, which is going to have more local elections later this year. And traditionally, that has not worked out very well for Beijing. Past attempts to intimidate the Taiwanese people to vote a certain way in elections have backfired on Beijing. Yet it continues to try. And, you know, over the last 20 years, we've seen that the percentage of the Taiwanese population that identifies purely as Taiwanese and not Chinese has grown pretty dramatically. I mean, in 1992, a survey by National Zhengzhou University, which they do every year, showed that 17.6% of the population identified as Taiwanese. And by last year, that was up to 55.3%. And the percentage identifying as Chinese had dropped to just, I think, 3.6%. So, time is not on the mainland side here, and its tactics seem to be backfiring. Yet there is a third audience for this, which is, of course, the Chinese domestic audience. Right. And, the Chinese leadership is also playing to them of portraying themselves as the champions of Chinese nationalism and the leadership that will reunify the country.
I'm disturbed that China is able to exert leverage to this degree over a U.S.-based company, Hugo. And it reminds me of an incident a couple of months ago where a fellow, Roy Jones was his name, who ran a social media account for Marriott, liked a tweet from a Tibet group. Tibet, of course, was subjugated by the Chinese Communist Party. The Tibetans are treated horribly, et cetera. We don't have to rehearse that history here. But he was fired after just liking something on Twitter. Now, you can argue about whether or not, Marriott has a policy of not liking, you know, political groups or engaging in that kind of thing. But it seemed to me an innocent thing, and he lost his job.
Mm-hmm. Well, China is definitely increasing the pressure in so many different ways. I mean, the East Asian Youth Games of the Olympics were scheduled to be held in Taiwan in August 2019, and those were canceled recently by the IOC, by the Asian branch of the IOC.
And that's that's a lily white organization. It stands for truth and justice.
Right. So maybe you see it's more remarkable that they were ever going to have youth games in Taiwan. But, you know, these kinds of cultural interchanges and sport are supposed to be non-political and an opportunity to build bridges, you know, across the Taiwan Strait and across other political divides. China has politicized these to the extent that the Taiwanese are essentially pariahs. And they are one of the most democratic countries in the world and one of the most prosperous very important to the supply chains of American companies for electronics and other manufactured goods. So as well as being a past military ally of the United States and fighting alongside us in Korea, for example. So, we have allowed China to push us to the point where we acquiesce in this marginalization of Taiwan. But you have to wonder at what point do we start to push back and say, enough is enough, and we're simply going to expand the recognition of Taiwan, whether you like it or not.
Well, Hugo, look, you raise a good point that the companies were put in an impossible spot. It really is incumbent on the U.S. government to do that pushing back. And what a wonderful project it would be, for instance, for Nikki Haley to raise a stink about getting Taiwan into the World Health Organization, which should have happened years ago. And what a fantastic mission it would be for Secretary Pompeo's staff to rally allies around increasing the diplomatic ties with Taiwan, you know, whether it's establishing closer ties or sending higher level people over, or I don't know, you know, calling the U.S. embassy in Taipei what it is, which is a U.S. embassy instead of the American Institute of Taiwan. Right. Now, a lot
and
of people might see that as very
to sell more arms
right.
to Taiwan, and I think you know we have to throw that into the mix as well, because the failure of past administrations to sell sufficient arms for Taiwan to defend itself has left the island in a pretty precarious state, and if there was a conflict, it could draw the U.S. in, and that decision not to sell arms in the past may end up costing American lives. So it's really in our interest to tighten the security links between the U.S. and Taiwan.
And also, Hugo, I think a lot of other countries around the world, small nations, democracies that the U.S. protects, looks to Taiwan and how Taiwan is treated. Because if we ever did abandon the island, you know, what would that say to a place like Israel or a place,
Singapore, yeah.
Right? These countries can't entirely defend themselves, but they're very important to the global economy. They're strategically located, and American deterrence rests on our umbrella. Our ability to indicate to a country like China, don't mess with these places, or you're messing with us.
I agree totally. I mean, it's a matter of credibility. It's also a matter of strategic balance in Asia. I mean, if Taiwan were ever to be taken over by China, it would be a huge setback for democracy. The other countries around it would then be threatened by Chinese forces on Taiwan, the balance of power in Asia would shift irrevocably in a way that would essentially push the U.S. out of East Asia.
Well, this tug of war over the name is much more than just a name. We'll leave it at that. Thanks for listening to Foreign Edition. On behalf of Hugo Rustall and me, Mary Kissel, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Wednesday.